Welcome to the Hands-On Business Podcast, a place you come to get tips, tricks, and advice on growing your business. As you know, this is a podcast where you can hear real business leaders discussing systems and methodologies that they have used to help them catapult growth in their businesses. As I've grown several small businesses to multi-million dollar enterprises, I've noticed that there wasn't really a place to focus on where I was. It all seemed to be around big businesses and often just a lot of theories but not practical, implementable advice. So, I focus on getting people on this show who are doing it, not just talking about doing it, so you can get real, actionable takeaways which you can implement immediately into your business. Today, I was delighted to invite Kath Brooks on the show. Mathematician, opera singer, yoga teacher, and more importantly for this episode, Kath is the owner of the Resonance Coaching Initiative, providing executive coaching, leadership development, and many, many other things. So relax and get ready for Kath to give you 5 tips on being a better leader, which as always, if you follow these tips, will drive a happy, productive team and hence results. Hello again, and welcome to the Hands-On Business Podcast. Now, as you all know, I love having guests on where I don't really know who they are, and I don't know them that well. And the reason why I enjoy that is because you never know where the conversation is going to go. You don't know what rabbit hole you're going to go down. So it's very interesting because you get the great value, and it's just unexpected. The only thing, however, that I like better than that is that when you've got people on that you have known for years, where you are confident where the conversation is going to go, and you've got guarantees that you're going to get great value. So today is one of those days, and I'm delighted to welcome to the show Kath Ricks. When I knew her first off, she wasn't Kath Ricks. That's why on the show. Now, a lady I first met back in 2004, I believe, when we both worked for an Italian pharma company, and we're going to, you know, that name should remain nameless for now, just in case, as we start going through, we say something that we shouldn't. So we'll keep that on the back burner for now. Not only did we work for the same company, I believe that we might have actually even gone to the same university, but at different times. So we never met at university. So delighted to be joined by Kath Ricks today, and welcome to the Hands-On Business Podcast. So Kath is now... Back then, I can't remember what you did. You did a variety of sales people in marketing, etc.
I did all sorts of stuff.
Yes, I know you did everything. But Kath is now a team dynamics and performance coach, owner of the Resonance Coach Limited, and providing executive coaching, leadership development, amongst many other things, which obviously I'm sure we're going to get into today. So welcome again.
Thank you, Hakeem. It's lovely to see you again. It's been a very long time, far too many years for us both to admit.
Yes,
I won't say it out loud. We've said it to each other already. But thank you for the invitation. I'm delighted to see where this conversation goes and do my best not to disappoint.
You won't. I know that. And you know that. So just on that, Paul, before we get into the meat of the show, you say hang around with me for long enough and you'll believe you can achieve anything. Now, I know you still know that's true. But for my listeners, can you just elaborate what you mean by that?
Oh, 100%. Well, I stole that quote. I'm not even sure where it comes from. I think it's one of those quotes that you could attribute to lots of different people and is really anonymous because we don't know where it came from. So for most of my life, I've been described as an optimist, and not necessarily in the way that means everything is always all right, don't worry about it. But certainly when it comes to people, I have two core beliefs. One is that most of us, if not all of us, are doing our very best every single day. And if we're having a bad day and things go a little worse than we'd like, or if we happen to be a bit unkind or a little bit sharp with people, it's because we're not having a great time ourselves. So I look at things from the perspective of, I think everybody's doing their best. But alongside that most of us don't really realize our own potential. I think that I go further than that. I believe that my superpower is that I'm able to read people. I often know what their backstory is without them telling me. And I'm intrigued by what makes people behave the way that they do. And the idea that if you spend enough time with me, you'll believe that anything is possible for you comes from the idea that I will open up your eyes to what you could be. That I won't tell you what you are, but I'm really happy to ask you questions, to suggest ideas and to ask you why you're stopping yourself doing everything you just dreamed of. I'm a great believer in manifesting, and I've manifested a huge number of things in my life, in every single aspect of my life. And that just started with believing that anything is possible. In fact, I'm drinking coffee out of a mug that my sister gave me. So somebody who's known me my entire life, which states on the front of it, anything is possible. And a picture of somebody who isn't actually me, but the idea that I believe anything's possible. And I don't just believe that for me. I believe that for you. And the job, I think, of a coach is to imagine that everybody you coach is entirely creative, is whole, is resourceful, and can do absolutely anything, but puts so many limits in their behaviors in the way and stops, most of us stop ourselves from realizing everything we could be based on old stories of things that haven't quite worked out the first time.
So on that basis, just tell me a bit about your story. I know your story, but my listeners don't. And obviously when we met so many, many years ago, you do something completely different than what you do now. So tell me, fill in the gaps.
Okay.
How would you get to be owning the Resonance Coach, what you obviously passionately love?
Well, let's start early, because you mentioned that we went to the same university. And I always begin with, I went to university with the intention of becoming a math teacher because I was good at it. And in the vein of, I think I can help you believe anything is possible, I wanted to support and teach all of the kids the kind of kids I went to school with who didn't enjoy maths, who didn't understand it, to get it. And that had been my plan since I was, I don't know, probably seven. I was going to university. I was going to study to be a maths teacher. And alongside that, I am a trained opera singer. So those are the two things that were possible in my life. I had a big dream of being an opera singer, and knowing that because it's part of showbiz, it was just as difficult as anything else to get into. What would be my backstop? Went to university, discovered within the first few months, much as I really enjoy studying higher maths, that was what I would do for my first year. And in my first teacher training experience, I think it was 5 out of the 7 of us who were in teacher training in a classroom were attacked in some way by the children that we were supposed to be teaching. And I thought, I'm not sure this one's for me. So I think lesson one for me was, be prepared to let go of things that aren't serving you. I think quite a lot of time in life, we stop ourselves stopping because we think that means we're giving up. And I think there's a great deal of difference between giving up and letting go. I knew it wasn't right for me. I felt it in my gut. It was really disappointing for my family. I stepped away from being in university. I decided I would carry on singing. And then I found myself another job. And within a few months, I was working in an accounts team, a small business. It's how I stepped into healthcare. And I moved from being somebody who was sitting behind a desk doing accounting, because I was a mathematician, into finding myself as a buyer and eventually a marketing manager for a health and rehabilitation company. Back in the day when there was one company that made all of the walking sticks and crutches for the NHS, a long time ago. And that's how I first discovered what happened in healthcare. The business was bought and was moved to another part of the country I didn't want to go to. And I was given an opportunity to get out from behind a desk, which is where I was still spending a lot of my time. I was encouraged by the then marketing director to go and find a role where I would be in front of people all of the time. And he introduced me to the idea of medical repping, which at the tender age of 20, I had no idea what it was. I didn't know that there were medical reps. I didn't know that pharmaceutical companies sold in any way directly to doctors. And I stepped into a world where, and here's a beginning of the real story of anything is possible. I was the first person at that time to be hired into a role by what was then Astra Pharmaceuticals without a degree. So younger than anyone else who'd ever first started, and without the qualification they'd asked for, on the basis that the relationships I'd built with the person who interviewed me were really positive. And that's how I got into healthcare and pharmaceuticals. I got into understanding what was going on in the world. And I was utterly intrigued by the idea, first of all, that as human beings, we want to live forever, which is why pharmaceuticals and healthcare continue to be the fastest growing business in the world and tend to be, let's say, safer than many other environments. You know, not every drug comes to market, but we all do quite like the idea of prolonging our lives in some way as a race. So I made the decision that I would be in pharmaceuticals and explore what that could offer me. I spent quite a limited amount of time in sales, moved into marketing, and discovered that my passion at the time was in how healthcare spent money on health. So back nearly 20 years ago, the words market access in healthcare were quite new. We didn't know there was such a thing as a commissioner anywhere other than of the police, I think. And I started to explore what would happen in networks around purchasing, how somebody makes the decision between spending a certain amount of money on newborn babies or spending that same amount of money on a heart transplant. And knowing that budgets work in all sorts of different ways, the people who are responsible for buying decisions in the NHS had to be of a particular kind of character. And I wanted, as a marketeer, not just to know how to persuade them to do things, but to really understand what motivated them. And that saw me step into all sorts of different environments. I walked from that organization straight into a new company where I was facilitating advisory boards. I first discovered management consulting, and my job for about 15 years was looking at what the industry needed, what healthcare professionals needed and wanted, and how to make objectives match in the middle. So I went from marketing to consultancy, and that consultancy led me into becoming the best facilitator I could be. And I think of all of the jobs in the world, facilitation is probably the closest in my mind to coaching. Having a group of people in the room who don't know each other, who need to work together towards a common goal, who often think they're not going to like each other before they've even stepped into the room, as you're smiling, Riley, you've experienced this. And frankly, sometimes just want to cause a bit of trouble because they're having a bit of a bad day, going back to my original point about positivity in people. And I spent 15 years working in what is now a global healthcare company, both in communications and in strategy consulting. I've created strategy for some of the biggest brands that healthcare has heard of and worked with those teams to understand how they could better work together. And eventually found myself in a place where I realized what I really cared about was what really motivates human beings and what motivates them to work together. I learned somewhere, probably from training and experience, that we can't motivate other people, but what we can do is create environments where they are most likely to be motivated for themselves. Because actually motivation with stick or carrot tends to leave us in slightly difficult places sometimes. It can be brilliant short term, but it's not a leadership style I would advocate. And within the organization I worked for, where I went from being a principal in the business where I was responsible for generating income, running a large team, servicing clients throughout the year, to creating a role in organizational development, which was basically stepping into HR without being an HR specialist. And for the last 5 years in a commercial business before I built my own, I ended up being HR director for maybe 350 people, introducing competency frameworks, leadership styles, but really doing all of that and building and sharing tools for leadership and management of people whilst coaching, whilst being part of a leadership team that I recognized had the very best intentions but didn't always deliver them. And by the time I decided I wanted to step away from that world into my own business so that I could support and coach others, what I had realized, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about being the problem as a leader, so I realized then, and I realize even more now, and this is sometimes the ugly truth we admit to ourselves, is that I was part of some of the problems. That as a coach and as somebody who's very empathetic and likes to understand what it is that makes people behave the way they do, there were times when the behavior wasn't okay and I was colluding with it because I didn't want to create an environment where people couldn't just be how they needed to feel. I definitely did some brilliant things, and some of the things that I did were about how I felt about myself and how I wasn't role modeling the kind of leader I wanted to be, because I was afraid that maybe I wouldn't be as well liked if I was honest as if I just shut up occasionally. And I've just spoken solidly for 7 minutes, so I'm sure people can't imagine me shutting up, but that was certainly a big lesson for me that made me take the leap, and I think it always has to be a leap, into going and working with teams who invite me to help them evolve, to become better leaders, and to be honest with themselves about some of the problems they're creating and some of the stuff that's going on that's not even a real problem. You've just decided it is.
Well, this is a really good point to start our full conversation, because obviously what we want to talk about today, as you just alluded to, is, you know, looking at the importance of senior leadership and senior leaders and how they are critical in shaping organizational behavior and structure, of course, and how leading, and on the previous podcast, I've talked about this as well, but how leading shouldn't be, not if not, but it shouldn't be all about the leader. And I think, as you just said there, that, you know, if there's a problem, then it's probably you. And one of the things you just mentioned there was that, obviously, what I picked up, probably the difference between what you're doing now and what you were doing before, is that you're actually being invited in. So people have identified as a challenge or a problem, and therefore them, not saying everybody, but at least the senior leaders are receptive to you going in. So I suppose the challenge and the question is, elaborate more on, if the problem is there, it's probably you and not somebody else, but also how, in that experience that you've had where you are, you know there's a problem, you know that actually you could, as you said, either shut up or get involved, but you actually collude in the bad behavior. How do you break that? Because everybody's always worried about, well, I need to keep the team satisfied and positive, and if I say that, that's going to upset this person. So just, if that makes sense.
That's a lovely question. Thank you, Joaquin. I think there are two things. I think one is a very honest and heartfelt answer, which has not got anything to do with research or tools, but how I feel. And that is that somebody once taught me about loving or caring about someone enough to tell them the truth. So I am 100% by nature, and certainly by nurture, a people pleaser. I want people to feel good around me. I want to be kind. I want you to feel comfortable. But somebody once said to me, number one, that people pleasing is a version of manipulation. It's not the truth. And when you hear that as someone who's a people pleaser, who thinks you're a good person, which I do believe that, and I still think I am, and you are honest enough to say, yes, I'm actually manipulating them to like me, even though what I really need to say isn't true, it makes you take a good hard look at yourself, one. And what sits within that bracket as well is, if I really love someone, it's not about me. If I really care about you, then I will tell you how I feel. I will tell you that the impact of your behavior on others, because I know you don't intend it, is still this. It's not giving someone else responsibility for my feelings or anyone else's feelings, but it's saying, when you behave like this, other people think this about you. The story they tell themselves about you is this. And you know what? I believe that if I'm not prepared to tell you the truth enough that you could walk away from me and never speak to me again, then actually I don't really care about you at all. I care about me. Yeah. I care about you saying to me, oh, that's really lovely, thanks ever so much, Cass. And that's BS, isn't it? That's not what we're here for.
I think the challenge is that that's when you go on lots of training courses, that's effectively what they try to tell you to do. Well, oh yeah, just make them feel good. And you're like, okay, what are you talking about? Because I don't know if you will have heard of it, radical candor.
Yep. I love
this. Which is just perfect. And in fact, I was introduced to radical candor, but it wasn't called radical. The person who introduced me wasn't talking about radical candor, but he's one of my bosses, he's before I met you, actually. He's talking about Eden Longer. And he said to me, he wasn't actually speaking specifically to me, but he was telling me a story about what he believed about feedback. And he said, I'm not going to try and motivate you. I'm not going to try and demotivate you. I'm just going to tell you the truth. You know, and I just thought, that's so refreshing. Because up to that point, I'd been told, oh yeah, the old sandwich, give them the positives, then give them the negatives, then give them the positive. And you're thinking, well, it's not really authentic, is it? Because you really try to find the positive. And everyone's just thinking, yeah, just give me the bad news, please. And then you tie your shoelaces well, you know, you're like,
exactly. I know exactly what you mean.
And it doesn't feel, as you said, it doesn't feel nice. It doesn't feel authentic. Whereas if you're coming from a place, and I always have this conversation, especially if you're in a leader, manager, coach, you should be interested in developing people. If you're interested in developing people, you can only develop people if it's about them.
Yep.
You can only develop people if you tell them the truth. You can't develop people by lying to them, however well-intentioned that he's had. However, when they go, you know, they go away and they think, oh, Hakeem's great, he's so nice. And you think, and you're thinking, that guy's rubbish, but I can't tell him he's rubbish. You know, yep. And you don't have to, and it's not about being rubbish, is it? Which is what you're saying. It's about understanding everyone's trying to do the best and everyone has the potential to do better. And if you understand those two things, you can work with pretty much anybody and actually hopefully help them. You know, they might not be a world beater, but you can help them get better than they actually currently are.
100%. And also sometimes people just aren't right for you.
Yes.
You know, that's, isn't that what they say about any kind of relationships or anything in life? Could you not look at rejection as a mismatch? Could you not look at rejection as a way of saying, this isn't right for you? And our pain and suffering comes from us holding on to the things that aren't right for us, where if we could learn, and it's part of the, you know, it's part of humanity is to find that difficult. But as soon as you let it go and say, well, rather than it being good or bad, maybe it just is. And maybe feedback needs to start being a thing. Like a, the way I translate the idea of feedback being a gift is that, is a gift, you kind of go, isn't a gift lovely and positive? Well, the truth is that we're often given gifts we really don't like at all. But because it's a gift, because it was given with thoughtfulness and because it was given with intention, when I unwrap it, I can choose what I do with it. I can choose to re-gift it. I can choose to put it in the bin. I can choose it to put it in the cupboard, or I can choose to look at it and say, actually, maybe I could do something with this. Maybe I like this. And really importantly, I think the two things I've learned, once, first as a receiver of feedback, if it triggers a trigger in me and I am resistant to it, it's probably true.
Yeah, you're right.
And I, you know, and because it immediately, as soon as I become defensive, as soon as I come from a place that's fear-led rather than love-led, then I know that's because I'm afraid of something. I'm afraid that you might have caught me out doing. So one is, if I receive it with difficulty, maybe I need to put it down and come back to it later and go, let me have a look at it on my own and decide if this is true. But the other thing is that if I'm giving feedback to somebody, I need to give it and let it go. If I was giving you feedback, Hakeem, I need to give it and not expect you to do what I want you to do with it, not to love the present or to use the present every day, but to say, I'm giving this to you because I care. Now you choose.
Yeah.
And now, because I've now said it, I can walk away.
Yep.
And because the feedback thing, you and I both know, we've both been there. We might have even been there at the same time, where you don't give feedback to the person. You go and tell five other people how annoyed you are about the thing they didn't do very well.
Yeah.
And when the person in response says to you, have you told them? You go, no, it's not that important. Well, here's my view. If it's important enough for me to tell anyone else, I need to tell them. And I used to do this. It was maybe a bit of a mean thing to do as an HR director, but I used to often find leaders at all levels would come to me and say, so-and-so's been doing this and I need you to tell them that it's not right or I don't like it. And my response would be, have you told them? To which they would say, no, I think that's your job. You're better at that than I am, or some other stuff.
Yeah.
And the best response I think I ever gave, whether it was best for me anyway, was I'm more than happy to go and tell this person that you think this, but I'm going to start the conversation by saying so-and-so thinks this, but they don't want to tell you because they think they might upset you. But here's the thing. And you know what? They went and did it. They didn't like it, but they did it. So that, I suppose that wraps all of that stuff up in the first bit, which is the idea that there's a need to give honest feedback. There's a need to stop colluding and to disagree sometimes. From a research point of view, there's an amazing piece of work that I'm sure many of you are listeners will hear, which is around structural dynamics. And the idea that in any functioning team, family, you might call it constellation, there has to be a group, they call them four movers. And within that pattern, it could be four people in a team, 20 people in a room, there are people who move, the people who come up with the ideas that say, let's just start the meeting now, are movers, or are movers on that thing. There are a second group of people who are followers who go, yes, that's a good idea. There are a third group of people, I've forgotten what they call it now, but it's an opposer that goes, oh, I'm not sure, let's wait for so-and-so to arrive, or can we do this first? And the fourth is somebody who is the observer of the whole thing and can offer either a way of making everything nicer, because they see everyone's perspective, and I do this with my hands because that's what I used to do a lot of, or can just say, let's just look at the fact there are different perspectives in the room. And the argument that the author Cantor makes around structural dynamics is that if you don't have those four places or the four positions in a team, your team is not healthy. If every conversation doesn't have that in it, if you don't always have someone opposing, then you just all float along with ideas. Even if you've all agreed with it before, you probably want someone to just check in and go, really? Have you thought about the consequence of this? Have you thought about whether or not people are going to like it, particularly as leaders? So there's this heartfelt, I just need to care enough to tell the truth part of it, which I don't think we need research to tell us. But if you want research about it, then go and study a bit of yoga, because actually yogic philosophy says to you, do the right thing, success follows, whatever success looks like for you. And then there is reams and reams of research that says, you've got to speak up, you've got to tell the truth, whether you're Simon Sinek or Stephen Shedlesky or you're Ken Blanchard or you're anyone who's going, people need to trust leaders enough that they can speak up. And if they don't see you speaking up with each other in a courteous and radically candid but compassionate way, the rest of the business just thinks nobody ever disagrees with anyone except for behind closed doors or in corridors. And you end up colluding, as I did, with a team of people you really care about, but you're not serving at all.
Two things that I just picked out as you were talking. The first one was, so we're talking about radical candor and the being feedback being a gift. And earlier on, you were talking about, you know, you can't motivate people. You can only create an environment where people are motivated. And in my mind, part of that is exactly what you're saying. If you create the right environment, then people then accept feedback and actually look forward to feedback. Yeah. I think, actually, this person's saying it because they care about me. They care about my career. They want me to do better. And it might not even be a work-related thing. It might be a personal thing. But they give me feedback because they think this will be good for me. As you said, then you walk away. It's up to you. Just like any gift, I can give you a gift. You might hate it, you might love it, but it's a gift. And I gave it you with love. So it's up to you to decide what you want to do about it. And then the other thing that popped into mind as you were talking about these four movers. And I'm almost obsessed about this, because when I first went into management, I remember very clearly that I thought, to be successful as a salespeople, you have to be like me, you know, and to have a successful sales team, I had to have eight people who were like me, because I was successful. So if I'm successful, then this is success in sales. And it was only when I started getting out of people who were completely opposed to my characteristics, who were just nothing like me. And I'm thinking, they're bloody phenomenal. Well, maybe there is another way of success. And what I found with leadership, and it doesn't matter, and I'll use Boris. Boris is a perfect case in point, because Boris has surrounded himself generally with not people. He hasn't got those four types of managers.
No.
And I heard the other day that he said, well, this is just me, I can't change it. You're thinking, right, so how are you going to be a leader and you're saying that you cannot change? Because everybody can change and everybody should change. And it's about surrounding yourself with people who can do these things, because then you get to the best ideas, you get to the best environment. But nobody is upset when you have an opposer saying, well, actually, I think we should just wait on that, you know. And people want to bring ideas forward, because they know, actually, when we bring it to this group, because we've got these different type of movers, we get to a better decision all around for me and the business, right? Because I always say to people, if it's the best decision for the business, and I mean genuinely the best decision, it's the best decision for everybody in the business.
Yeah.
So that was when you were talking, that was good. But so in terms of that leadership element, how do you get to that enlightened position? I think is the best description.
Well, it's a good word to use. I don't say this all of the time in the programs that I run, because I'm aware of the fact that spirituality philosophy isn't what everybody is ready to hear at the beginning of conversations, but absolutely, and I hope you can even hear this from the way I speak. I'm a yoga teacher. I'm a yogi. I don't have a religion. I just believe that the philosophy of yoga, the idea of growth, but not necessarily. I think some would argue that yoga is about reaching enlightenment. I would argue, for me at least, that yoga and the philosophy of yoga is about going towards, you know, it's not about, what do they say? It's not about touching your toes. It's about what you discover about yourself on the way down to touching your toes.
Yeah.
It's how do I feel about being a bit uncomfortable today, a bit unable to do this? What's the story I tell myself? So that yogic philosophy comes through in the way that I communicate in what I do. And the answer for me is to start by looking at myself, or to look at ourselves as individuals. So when I work with teams, the first question I ask is how well do they know themselves? Not how well do you know each other? And traditional team building is brilliant. Team building is awesome. But I do believe that in order for us to be able to show ourselves to each other as a team, and let's be honest, whether you're a senior leadership team with 10 other people in your business, or 50 or 100 or 1,000, whatever money you're making, the most senior leadership team is the role model of leadership across the business. Whether we like or don't like what we see in leaders, if we're in their business, we behave like them either because we think it's good, or we think it's the way to succeed, or because we're a bit annoyed with them, so we just do it to be bloody minded. And that is a part of our nature that maybe we don't really like. But if we start from the idea that that close-knit team of senior leaders have got to know each other, the only way I can show you me is if I know me. So we begin with, who are you? And I use, you know, all of the personality tools are pretty much similar. They all come from the same kind of Freudian or Jungian principles. And we start with looking at how people react to their own personality profiles. So before we get anywhere near team dynamics, if I show you your 16 personality types version for you and you read it, which bits of it do you just go, uh-huh? Which bits of it do you know your family would go, uh-huh, but you don't really want to admit to? And which bits of it are you screaming at going, I never do that? And what's that? A bit like the feedback thing I just talked about.
Yes.
Now, they're not infallible, but I would say in most cases, 95% of what you get from a personality assessment is you. Because they're smart.
Yeah.
And if you go and spend some time with people around you who go, when you say, well, I don't do that, they'll probably go, yeah, you do. Probably only under pressure, but yeah, you do.
Yeah.
And from that place of I understand me and it's okay to be whatever I am today, we then ask ourselves the questions, what do I want to be? So if the way I'm showing up in the world is this, is that, and this is where resonance comes from, is that resonance with what I say I'm going to be? Is that, do I false advertise? Do I say, well, we are here and we put people first. I'm here and I'm always going to make time for you. And the reality is that when I make time for you, I'm on my phone. Or when I make time for you, I'm going to cancel it. How am I really showing up and getting honest with the sometimes, I'm going to use the word ugly parts of us, that maybe we just need to embrace. And to decide, do I want to keep them or do I want to change them? To your point about changing, we're supposed to evolve.
Yeah.
And by the time we're adults, the stories we were told as children about who we are and how we're supposed to behave and how we're supposed to eat with cutlery, we can decide for ourselves whether they're true or not. From that place, I can then share, one, who I am and why I show up in the world with my team, because I trust them and care about them enough to tell them who I am.
Yeah.
Two, I'm prepared to tell them the things that wind me up. Because it's not them, I suddenly realize the things that really bug me are if somebody doesn't have attention to detail from the first minute. That's what bugs me. That's not their stuff, it's mine. And if I can say, do you know what, Hakeem, it really annoys me if there's a spelling mistake somewhere and I realize that's mine, you're going to know that if you send me something as someone who's in my team, you're going to check it first. Or you're going to say, there might be some spelling mistakes, Cass. Don't worry about it. But you can not change who you are, but acknowledge that it's not you triggering me. It's you triggering my triggers.
Yeah.
And then we can choose to avoid them. We can work with them. We can be honest about them. We can notice when people are a bit stressed or a bit sulky or a bit shouty in meetings. And then thirdly, and most importantly, we can ask each other, because we've asked ourselves, what is success for me? Rather than assuming everybody is in the business for the same reasons. We all need to have a common purpose for the business. But my personal purpose might be that I can retire by the time I'm 60, that I can stay doing this job that I'm doing because it means that I can continue to collect my young children from school every day until they're old enough to drive themselves wherever they're going. But we don't admit to those things because we're worried that other people would judge us for it in our senior teams, because the more senior you get, the more sometimes unfair judgment we make about our colleagues. And we're then in a position to be able to say, do we need to change? Can we resolve our differences in this room rather than pretending everything's okay, thinking outside the boardroom? And that's very old style language, but you know what I mean. Yep. The rest of the organization doesn't know that we're having a bit of a disagreement. And starts to become a more, well, what you'd call a more high performing team. Or, and I'll be honest, to realize that some people aren't supposed to be in this team. When they decide that for themselves, because they're having these really honest conversations. For me, that's the journey towards enlightenment. For me as a team, I know you. I know that if you get annoyed about something, it's not me, it's you. I know that we are all in this together. And we don't actually have to like each other to be a functional team, but we do have to, I'm going to say it, we do have to love each other enough in the business sense to be honest and to let the rest of the business know that they are safe with us. Because like, I think an example I might give is like in constellation work, warring parents make children feel unsafe.
Yep.
Warring leaders, silent or shouty, make employees feel unsafe. And they either start behaving in ways we don't want them to, or they start leaving us. Going back to the original premise, if we think there's a problem in our business, it's us as leaders. Because if the person's not right for your business, you should have had that conversation anyway. If they're misbehaving, and I put that in inverted commas, in your opinion, maybe that's because the behaviors they're observing in you are not congruent with the way that you say you're going to be.
Well, it's an interesting point, because you're defining effectively, you know, the traits of a good leader in terms of, and I spoke to Rich Levine, who I know you're familiar with, we worked the other day, and he was talking about, which you just talked about that trust, the empathy. He also talks about humility and wraps it all in authenticity across the piece. And I think that those elements that you just mentioned, I think anyone who's listening would say, yeah, if I had a leader like that, I'd go to the end of the earth for them. Because the question I always ask is, if you're a leader, how comfortable, if you're being authentic, are you to accept feedback? Because you should be delighted to accept feedback. You're behaving as you want everybody else to behave, because you think it's the right way to behave in terms of authenticity, in terms of having radical candor. Radical candor, which I know most leaders will think is a one-way street, shouldn't be a one-way street.
No.
It should be a two-way street, because they're, as you said, they're looking at you and saying, right, well, I want to model that person's behavior because he's a leader and he's setting the tone. But if you're setting the wrong tone, and then I'm not able to tell you, well, what sort of leadership is that? So just on those four things, trust and empathy, you probably talked about actually, but humility and authenticity, what are your views around those?
So humility for me is about being able to admit two things: that I don't know and I've got it wrong.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know is a hard thing, I think, for most humans to actually admit, particularly in business.
Yeah.
Because we've been hired to do a job because we're probably good at it, or could be good at it based on our background. We like to think we hire bright people into businesses, and we're naturally problem solvers. It's a human trait, is to try and figure out a problem. And I do a lot of training. I'm a great advocate of Blanchard training. I deliver SL2 skill will kind of training, which is based on the idea that in order for people to get the kind of leadership they need, they have to be prepared to say they don't know how to do something or they don't know where to begin. And the one thing I constantly hear, whether I train this into leaders or their contributors, is I don't want to say I don't know because I think it makes me look incompetent. And my answer has often been, well, that's because you're not competent. You need to say I don't know. So the I don't know can be hard to admit. It can even be hard to admit. We're doing parents' evening last night, and my daughter's maths teacher said to me, because I was good at maths, she finds it harder to say to me I don't understand than she might to a mum who actually, I still don't understand how they do maths these days, so I'm pretty useless to her. But to someone who'd always struggled with it, because I'm not her partner in solving the problem, she's kind of going, I think she knows the answer. She's going to think I'm a bit dim, which isn't how I feel at all. So humility for me as a leader is about saying, I don't know how to do this. I want us to figure it out together. And I messed up. Or got it wrong. And sometimes they're different things. Sometimes I got it wrong is I made a judgment about this. Oh, I made a judgment about you and I was wrong. Sometimes I messed up is, you know, I started this conversation really clumsily. I read a post from a friend of mine who's a pretty senior leader in a big IT company. And he was just sharing it with the world that he was on a train last night with somebody. And the guy was sitting in his seat on the train. And they had a bit of a thing because, he ended up in his real seat and the other guy sat somewhere else. And it was all a bit. And after about 15 minutes of sitting on the train, listening to or watching his film, he took his headphones off and he apologized. He said, you know what? I didn't handle that very well. And I can't even tell you why. It just wasn't the right thing to do. And how many of us feel like that with our teams? That, you know, I said that and I didn't mean it to come out that way. And sometimes apologies can't be immediate because we haven't figured out what we did wrong. But I got it wrong. I messed it up. I said something that was a bit unfair. I wasn't having a good moment. So I just was really short with you, whatever. And saying, I got it wrong. I'd like you to forgive me. And hoping that that happens. And alongside that, what you said a moment ago, Hakeem, about feedback, that's the thing is, maybe we don't get feedback very often, but maybe we're just not asking.
Yeah.
But we're not saying, you know, I'd really love you to tell me the things you want me to do more of and less of. Not, have you got any feedback for me? Because you know what the answer is to that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, asking those open questions. So humility is about that. Humility is about knowing that I don't know, and also admitting to my weaknesses, fessing up, saying, you know what, I'm not really very good at this and I need you to help me because every time I try and do this, I kind of give up on it. I'm not interested, for example. And then authenticity. There's a great book that talks about bringing your whole self to work. I don't think I've got it right here, somewhere on my bookcase. And in it, the author talks about the distance between inauthenticity, it might not be that word, authenticity and phoniness. Okay. And we were talking earlier on about a leader we both worked for who was utterly authentic. He made the decision that he was not going to bring his whole self to work. Now, that's kind of the opposite to what Mike Robbins says, but, you know, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
But you knew what you were going to get with this guy every day. He worked 8:30 till 5. He took an hour for lunch. It was who he was. And actually, I got to know him a bit personally after I left. And he's a lovely guy. I always thought he was a good guy. He was authentic about who he was prepared to be at work. And he never wavered. You didn't wake up in the morning or go into the office and think, oh, my goodness, who is he going to be today? You always knew. And that is authenticity. Phoniness is that I'm going to be nice to everybody. And they're not really sure whether or not it's true. Phoniness is, my moods are going to mean that one day I'm all over the place and the next day I don't really want to talk to anybody. And down the other end, which is about kind of inauthenticity, is when you're hiding, when you're pretending, when you're colluding with bad behavior. And we all move along that scale, by the way. Being a perfect leader is being fallible, getting it wrong, being a bit inauthentic, being a bit phony, being authentic sometimes. Being prepared to admit that every single one of us is a work in progress. So if I ask myself today, how did I do today? What would I give myself out of 10? Maybe it's only a 5. And maybe I'm okay with that. I think Steve Bartlett recently put something out. I'm dropping loads of names only because I feel really inspired by so much of what I see in the world today. It's not because I know these people personally, maybe one day, but because he was talking about the idea that, you know, if you can honestly say I did my best today, but my best was only a 5 on the authenticity scale, that's all right. Leave it alone, because that was yesterday.
Yes.
Stop carrying it around with you and just be who you are.
It's a critical point, isn't it, that you can't, time is the one thing you don't get back. You can't be worrying about what you did yesterday because you can't change it. What you can do is, I can change what I do now. I can change what I do later on today. I can change what I do tomorrow. And it's about putting yourself in that space so that actually you're always striving to do better, which is what you talked about earlier. And actually, I like what you're saying about the authenticity, because you talked about earlier, because you can only get to that stage when you know yourself, which is exactly how you said you start most of your training. Because if you don't know yourself, you don't know what authentic is. You know, as you said, the chap we're talking about, he knew 100%, this is me at home, and I'm going to give this to my family. But when I come to work, this is me. And as he said, it never caused any real problems, because every single person in that organization knew what you were going to get, knew what he would do, knew how he'd behave in every single circumstance. So you never sat there and thought, can't believe he's done that. You're thinking, well, I know how he's going to respond. So it's really, really interesting. So if you were to distill a few of those, let's say 5 or how many tips you got, just 5 key tips. Mm-hmm. If I'm listening and I'm thinking, right, so Cass has talked about loads of stuff, it's all really good. I can obviously go on one of her courses. I can employ her, which I'm sure I employ you to do. But, you know, if there's 5 things that I could say, I go away today and I want to try this, I want to try that, I want to try that, I want to try that, what would they be?
Okay. I think, let's say number one is something that you do for yourself and others. So ask for some feedback. And ask for some feedback in a way that gives permission for people to answer honestly. So what is it? Great. I'm sure it's somebody else's question, but what do you want me to do more of and less of? There's always something. And then, so that's one, ask for the feedback. 2 is, when you hear that feedback, listen to it properly. Maybe ask if you're going to do it on Zoom, record it with permission. We talked about that earlier. Or write it down and say to them, do you mind that? One of the best conversations I ever had with a leader before I shifted jobs into HR is, he said, do you mind if I write this down? Because I really want to hear you, not defend myself and be able to read it later. And he's still got the notes he made about 7 years ago. And notice the times when you're writing it or listening to it where you feel a bit triggered, where you go, yeah, that's not fair, where you want to open your mouth and say, but the reason I do that, don't do that. Don't say, but don't say, can I just, don't talk over them. Shut up.
Yeah.
And do a little red star, whatever it is that works for you, that lets you know, and then go and read it again and be honest with yourself on your own. Are those things that trigger me? Because I know they're true and I either don't want to change them or I don't know how. That's 2. 3, well, maybe this is part of the first, say thank you. In fact, say thank you all the time. You can never say thank you too many times to everybody, but say thank you to the person that's given you the feedback, because if that is what building a speak up culture is about, is saying thank you to people who tell you things you didn't want to hear because you need to hear them. And do them the honor of going back and saying, with some humility, I noticed that the couple of things that really bugged me that you said was this, and I think I know why, if you feel that your relationship's the right way of doing that. But you can either just say thank you, that's 3, or say thank you and here are some things I've learned. That's 3. 4, figure out the stuff that annoys you. Be honest with yourself about it. Recognize that other people do not annoy you. You become annoyed by things that other people do because of really, really old stories.
Yeah.
And maybe if you could put the story down and hear their view of the world, you could have a more, with a bit of opposition, honest conversation that says, well, maybe we don't have to meet in the middle, but I'd just like to understand your position on this and you to understand mine. Not every conversation has to end in agreement or agreement to even disagree. You can just have opposing views and stay friends. It's all right. Yeah. So that's the fourth thing, is be honest and tell people what it is that bugs you. And maybe that's, I'll come back to where, how they link into all the trust and empathy and humility. And I would say the fifth thing is say the thing that needs to be said in your leadership team and then let it go. Don't carry around how you feel about other people into their future. It's the most liberating thing you can do, is forgive somebody for doing something that they did to you, particularly in a work environment, because resentment is a burden you carry, not them. They just think you're being a bit weird with them, just so you know.
I'm laughing because I say that to my kids all the time. I said, when you're upset with somebody, I said, do you think you're stomping around the house, just piss them that. I said, do you think they're bothered? They're enjoying themselves out and where they're living. And I said, it's not affecting you. It's not affecting anybody else. So what's the point?
Exactly. The most you can hope for is that they're a bit confused, but yeah. They can't spend their entire day, entire lives feeling a bit confused about you. They've got their own stuff to deal with.
Exactly.
And I think all of those things, if you build a leadership team that has the trust of each other, then the business will trust you. If you care enough to say thank you and to tell people honestly that you hear their feedback, that's empathy. Humility is saying, this is the stuff that triggers me, annoys me, and means that I'm not really listening to anything else you said after you've said that one thing and I now look down at my book and furiously scribble or doodle. That's humility. And authenticity, I think, is all of those things wrapped up. Is maybe a way of describing authenticity is about self-awareness, which, by the way, is pretty useless without self-management.
Yeah.
Self-awareness and making a choice. Authenticity is a choice. I'm going to choose to be this now because what I need to be now is this, and I'm not going to... Maybe this sounds a bit harsh, but I'm going to say it. I am not going to let myself down by not being what I need to be. I'm not going to abandon the version of myself that needs to be really honest with you right now in order to make you feel better. I'm just going to be me right now.
And I think the interesting thing is, you've been through those five points. I always ask people when I speak to experts, because when they break it down, you'll think, well, that's simple enough, isn't it? So the question I always ask you, so why don't people do it? Because you know, and I know, we've all got examples of people who don't do anything like that and are, we'd consider pretty bad leaders or not as effective as they could be. So why is it that people don't gravitate towards it? Because a lot of the stuff you're talking about are human traits that actually, if you instigate those, whether it's in a leadership position, in a family position, people tend to gravitate and warm towards you, because people do like people with authenticity and integrity. So why don't people do it?
The honest answer, I think, is because we're afraid. And fear, we operate underneath all of it from two basic drivers, fear and love.
Yep.
Fear is very strong in us as humans, and our brain is wired to protect us from things we think are dangerous.
Yeah.
The thing is that our brains aren't able to tell the difference between being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, as we were many millions of years ago, or having a sweaty palm conversation with somebody who we don't want to upset. It can't tell. Excitement and fear are the same, and terror are the same kind of feelings in our body. Our body can tell us what's going on, but our brain's going, run!
Yeah.
So we're afraid. We're afraid of admitting we're wrong, because we're supposed to know all the answers, particularly the more senior you get as a leader. Everybody thinks I know all the answers. Oh my God, I can't admit I need help. Two is that we're afraid that people won't respect us or like us so much because we don't know everything. Three, and here's the doozy, I think this is the real one, is that if we are honest enough to recognize that we are making these decisions, we have to take responsibility. We cannot blame the government, the weather, society, Putin, whatever. We can't blame anyone for what's going on with us right now. The way I react right now to my computer not working, needing to phone someone, whatever, is about me. And as soon as I'm honest enough to speak to a coach, a therapist, go and talk to somebody, be in a team and be honest, I've got to take responsibility. And responsibility is very scary. Because as soon as I say, do you know what, it's not actually you, this is definitely me, this issue is us as a leadership team, we've got to do something with it. That's why.
Thank you very much. And that wraps up quite nicely, actually, in terms of where we started. It was about, you know, if there's a problem, it's probably you and not your team. And that, I think that's so critical. I think Cass has explained it quite eloquently in terms of the things that you need to do to avoid that. So just in terms of leadership resources, because there'll be people who are listening and thinking, right, oh, that's all really good. I can watch the podcast, I can get the show notes.
Yep.
But Cass has mentioned about 50 different resources. How bloody hell am I going to remember that? So where would be the best start? Again, it's about self-discovery. So if you're a leader, if you listen to this and you're a leader and you want to improve, if you don't want to improve, you're probably not listening to this, actually, and you're not going to do anything. If you want to improve, where should be the starting point? What should they do first?
You know, I would say start with Ken Blanchard. Because the Blanchard companies are a research-led organization, you can just search Ken Blanchard. He's the guy who wrote The One-Minute Manager many, many years ago. He's nearly 90. He's been talking about leadership being about other people, not you, since time began.
Yeah.
He basically says that anybody who thinks that that's just the way I was brought up in leadership, he kind of suggests that that's not true.
Yeah.
If you go to KenBlanchard.com and go to the resources, not only do they have constantly updated white papers, books, blah, 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 they also recommend other people. Follow Simon Sinek on LinkedIn or listen to some podcasts. And if you type in top 10 leadership books, often they're not wrong. They're probably the bestsellers in Amazon. And you can have a look and see what really works for you. And I was the co-host on a podcast, which was called The Search for the Soulful Leader. And we in there recommended a whole bunch of books that I've read, we've done reviews on. So if you know, I'm not saying don't listen just to this podcast, go and listen to that one, but mainly for the resources in there. Or find me on LinkedIn. I'm not doing this because I'm just trying desperately to find lots of people to work with. But if we can connect and you want to talk and you want to say, what would you recommend? Find 15 minutes in my diary. And I can lend you some books, send you some books, gift you some Audible books. Because I think as much as possible, the more of us who are reading and hearing and starting to keep this movement alive, the better.
Yeah, and it just makes it more enjoyable, doesn't it? If you're in a workplace which is defined by the principles you just defined, you're going to enjoy your life. You're going to enjoy the work life. You're going to enjoy your home life. People are going in, and it just makes... Apart from the fact that you'd be more successful, because it's proven, which is always nice, but you're going to enjoy your working environment. So that's why I always ask that question, because I always think, it can't be that enjoyable unless you're a particularly unpleasant person. You're in an environment where you know that people don't like where they're working and they're modeling your behavior, which isn't positive. And you can see it in others, and you can see lots of attrition, you can see lots of people backbiting and not getting on with it. You're thinking, is that really what you want? And your key tips have really given me and my listeners that transition. Well, if you want to get from there to there, these are just the simple things that you need to do. And if you do that, no one's saying it's going to change overnight, but it will start to change and you'll start to see the benefit of the work you put in. So thank you very much for that, Cass.
You're so welcome.
I say this all the time to everybody. I could genuinely, because you like to talk, I love to talk. So we could probably be here for about 5 hours and we still would exhaust everything that we want to discuss.
Awesome.
But I always have to protect everyone's time, because otherwise, I remember when I first started, I'd be going on for like an hour and a half, and you could see people thinking, didn't you say it was going to be an hour?
I know that feeling.
So I always say, right, if I say an hour, it has to be an hour. So thank you very much for that.
You're so welcome.
We'll go out, and obviously all of the resources that Cass mentioned will be in the podcast description. So we'll have a LinkedIn profile and all that good stuff, so you'll be at contact there. And I don't mind you going to watch other podcasts, because if I could be part of the movement that's podcast said, which then leads you to be a better leader. I don't care whether it's my podcast that's done it. As long as you're doing it, I'm happy. So thank you very much, Cass. And we'll see you on this slide. So there you go. Some great steps on how we can get a leader. I absolutely love catching up with talented people that I personally work with. And this episode with Cass gave some fantastic steps on how you can become a better leader. Too many highlights to choose from, but if you're listening to this outro, then obviously you listen to the podcast, so you know that already. Now, if I was to pick out one thing that really stuck in my mind, I'd love the way Cass talked about feedback and it being a gift. That was an analogy that I hadn't heard before, and believe you and me, I've heard pretty much every analogy in the business world. But I'm going to be using that myself in terms of thinking about how you give and receive feedback. Now, as Cass said, leadership is about the team, it's not about you. And if there is a problem in those team dynamics, performance and results, then stop looking at other people, as the problem is probably you. As you know, I always say, check out the show notes at www.thesalesaccelerationformula.com. And if you liked what you've heard, please give it a positive review. And if you didn't, then keep it to yourself. Keep listening and keep growing.